Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, President Obama to Congress on the debt crisis, get it done.
Leaders at a certain point rise to the occasion, and they do the right thing for the American people. And that's what I expect to happen this time. Call me naive, but my expectation is that leaders are going to lead.
The Minnesota government shuts down as budget talks stall. Here's Democratic Governor Mark Dayton.
I deeply regret that the last week of intense negotiations between the Republican legislative leaders and Senator Bach, Representative Thiessen, and myself have failed to bridge the divide between us.
Protests in Greece after the parliament passes a tough austerity plan. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable. Today we have Susan Davis of the National Journal, Greg Ipp of The Economist, and On Point's Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What did you hear in the president's challenge to Congress? Do you share frustrations of the Greek protesters? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Susan Davis joins us from Washington, congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Susan, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And Greg Ipp joins us from Washington as well, the U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty, joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Susan, and Greg.
So we have to start with this dramatic standoff in Washington over the vote to raise the debt ceiling or not. President Obama clearly raised the stakes and the tension with his press conference on Wednesday. It was the first one he'd held in 4 months. And in talking about the debt ceiling vote, he said the days are counting down.
By August 2nd, we run out of tools to make sure that all our bills are paid. So that is a hard deadline. And I want everybody to understand that this is a jobs issue. This is not an abstraction. If the United States government, for the first time, cannot pay its bills, if it defaults, then the consequences for the U.S. economy will be significant.
First, Greg Ipp, let's do a little fact-checking here. What are the actual stakes here? Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says Republicans are trying to coerce the Treasury to renege on existing legal commitments. What really is at stake here, Greg?
Well, the stakes are pretty huge, Tom. I mean, right now we have a situation where the Treasury, for every dollar that the Treasury spends, they have to borrow about 40 cents of that. So that means every month they have to issue over $100 billion of new debt to lenders, whether it's here at home or in China, in order to keep the government going. But the authority to do that is governed by something called the debt ceiling, and that authority essentially maxed out a few months ago. Treasury's been doing some bookkeeping maneuvers to get a bit more room, but they tell us by August 2nd on the most recent update, those maneuvers will run out of room and they will have to stop paying something. Now, Geithner has been careful not to specify what it is he will stop paying. In theory, he could stop paying Social Security checks. He could stop paying salaries to soldiers. He has not specified that what he will stop paying is interest on our bonds. That is what most people in the markets would consider a catastrophic default. But on the other hand, suddenly slashing federal spending overnight by around 40% ain't going to be no picnic either. I mean, not only will it deal a body blow to an economy that is extremely weak, you're going to have an incredible firestorm on Congress as everybody from people who can't get into national parks or can't get passports or Social Security recipients who are suddenly denied their checks start complaining. It'll be chaos.
And that's not even considering what might be going on in the financial markets.
Absolutely. I mean, some people say, look what happened when Congress first rejected the TARP bank bailout in the fall of 2008. The Dow fell about, 700 points. This would probably be worse.
Susan Davis, with all the attention on what has not been agreed and the gulf between the White House and the Republicans, I think we may have lost some focus on what has been agreed. In terms of the spending cuts that have been agreed between Democrats and Republicans alike, where does that stand?
You know, they haven't released a very specific list of where they've agreed on the spending cuts, but they have said that they have a framework of roughly $1 trillion over 10 years that both sides have sat down and said that they can get somewhere in that ballpark. Where they don't agree, where they want to have a target probably of at least $2 trillion over 10 years, is where do you get the other trillion from? And I think Republicans are saying almost across the board, you get it with more spending cuts. And Democrats are saying it is bad policy and it is not reasonable to think that you can fix the fiscal picture of this country on one side of the ledger. And they would like to see revenues as part of this debate. The problem is, politically, even if the president and the leaders of both chambers of Congress went into a room and said, we have this deal, you fundamentally just can't pass a tax increase through this Congress. With Republicans in control of the House and a more divided Senate, even if the leaders were to get there, it would be very hard to get it through the chambers. So the thing that Greg says that I completely agree with, not only from the policy implications, but the political implications of this are very significant. And I would say the stakes are almost dramatically higher than what we saw earlier this year during the shutdown debate, when we had this sort of apocalyptic conversations about what would happen if the government ran out of money and had to start shutting down. I think that the consequences of this are far, far greater.
Well, Jack Beatty, the president, if anything, raised the political tension with his withering critique of Republicans in that Wednesday press conference, actually saying that the Republicans are acting like school kids and comparing them unfavorably to his daughters, Sasha and Malia, who he said never pull all-nighters and actually get their work done on time. How do you see the politics of this shaping up?
Well, you know, for Republican members of Congress, a vote to raise any taxes, even ending corporate welfare programs like oil subsidies, that's likely to provoke a well-funded primary challenge. That's the controlling political reality in the debt ceiling showdown. You know, the president says he's not naive, believing that Republican leaders will lead their rank and file to a balanced deal, that is, tax spending cuts and tax increases. But it is naive to expect politicians to risk their careers to vote for something they abhor, more government borrowing to benefit a president they vow to defeat. You know, the politics of default are certainly murky. Default would grievously hurt the economy, but in election years, that's the president's lookout, or so Republicans might calculate. They claim that uncertainty is what's wrong with the economy. Default would intensify uncertainty. They have been predicting that Obama's profligacy will spike interest rates. Default will spike interest rates. You know, it's not in their political interest to raise taxes, the Republicans. Default just may be. But the risk is so great for them. If we consider this, Social Security recipients are due to receive a $23 billion payment on August 3rd, the day after the debt ceiling deadline. The government is expected to take in $12 billion that day, but would owe $32 billion. If it can't borrow for that, the Social Security recipients won't get their Social Security. Seniors vote, angry seniors mobilize, trouble for Republicans.
Well, it sure doesn't seem, Jack, like the Republicans were very intimidated by what President Obama said in that press conference. Here's Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas.
This is a grand opportunity for Democrats and Republicans to come together to do the nation's business, to be serious, not to be reckless, not to give demagogic speeches like the president gave yesterday as part of his reelection campaign.
Susan Davis, I want to go back to you now. You mentioned before, and Jack reinforced it, sort of the legislative difficulty of actually getting any revenues, tax increases passed in Congress right now. But who controls the narrative? To use a Washington sort of paradigm here, which of these two stories, the president's story or the Republican story, is really going to resound with the public, do you think?
I think right now, part of the reason why I think you saw the president come out so forcefully this week is I think it's a sort of a way of acknowledging that Republicans have an upper hand in this narrative. I think that they still, coming off the shutdown negotiations in which they did successfully get some spending cuts extractions without raising revenues earlier this year, you have the politics of the Republican Party, which is now defined largely on Capitol Hill by this Tea Party element that was elected in November of 2010. And the word that I hear most often from Republican lawmakers I talk to is transformative, that they see that this debt ceiling debate as a transformative moment in politics and in policy, that they're not going to – they think that – I mean, I have to be perfectly honest. I think $1 trillion or $2 trillion is seen by a lot of these members as not good enough, that they want to go as high as $4 trillion, $5 trillion. So I think in a lot of ways they have the upper hand. Now, if the government were to default, if we do reach this worst case scenario and things do start to fall on that line, I think at that moment the president can regain an upper hand in that narrative, because real people, real Americans outside of Washington, people with mortgages, people invested in the stock market will feel the effects of this. And I do not think when regular people's lives start to be affected, they will side with the Republican argument that now was just a transformative time and a $2 trillion wasn't good enough.
And now let's turn our attention to Greece. The Greek parliament, in a very similar situation to what Washington is facing, passed a five-year, 28.4 billion euro austerity package. That's about 41 billion U.S. dollars. Liani Kanelli is an independent member of parliament who voted against the austerity package.
There is a war going on in Greece, and it's a war against the working class, against working class rights, against mothers and fathers and handicapped people.
And we're going to be going back to Greece now after the break. Greg Ipp, Susan Davis, and Jack Beatty, please hold. We're talking about the week in the news. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a busy week in the news with Greg Ipp of The Economist, Susan Davis of The National Journal, and our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. And Greg Ipp, just before the break, we heard from that independent member of the Greek parliament who this week voted against the austerity package. But, of course, that austerity package did pass. And then just yesterday, the Greek parliament also approved the enabling legislation to make sure that those austerity measures actually could take place. Some $40 billion in cuts plus privatizations amounting to the equivalent of $72 billion. And yet, Greg, there seems to be a sense here that what we've done here is buy some time. How much progress really is being made toward a resolution of Greece's fiscal crisis?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is that I would disagree a little bit with what you said before the break when you said it's very similar to what's happening here.
Okay.
You know, the headlines look similar, but the reality is fundamentally different. What Greece has is a problem with its ability to pay. That is to say, they are so bust that only the official community, its fellow members of the European Union and the IMF, will lend to it. And that is why it now must pay 30% on its bonds. In the United States, there's no question about our ability to pay or borrow. It's a political question. Do we have the will to actually give ourselves the authority to do it? And that's why our bonds yield so little. And that's crucial to understanding what happened this week in Greece. For all the riots we've seen over the savage spending cuts and austerity that that country is undergoing, it was almost a foregone conclusion that the majority party would vote on party lines and carry this bill, because the alternative was simply too horrible. It would have meant default, which would have brought down not only many of Greece's banks, but many of France's and Germany's possibly as well. That would have ricocheted across the ocean, for example, to our money market funds. This vote unlocks the way for a second package of aid to come to Greece in the coming days, so that they can meet some of the bond payments that are coming up. But as you hinted at, it doesn't change the fundamental problem. I mean, even with this new aid, we're just piling new debt on top of old debt. Greece's debt ratios are simply unsustainable. They're headed for about 160% of GDP. You know, for comparison's sake, ours are less than 90%. And very few independent economists think that the Greek population is willing to keep paying the staggering interest bill that those debts require when all that money is going to other countries and they're being forced to tighten their belts. A more sensible solution would be to own up to the fact that Greece is bust, to write down the value of the debts that it owes, much as banks in this country must do with mortgages of people who are underwater and unemployed, and then let Greece have the ability to start over. The problem is that many people in Europe simply cannot countenance the possibility of default, and so they keep muddling through with these band-aids. So we got through the crisis this week, but the odds are we'll have another one before the year is out.
Well, I take your point, Greg, that the situation in Greece is not exactly the same as in Washington, but there is an interesting issue, it seems to me, that is being debated in both cases, and that is, what is the effect of spending cuts on economic growth? I mean, the big concern, as I understand it, in Greece has been that these draconian spending cuts could actually hurt the economy so much that tax revenues, even if rates are not increased, the tax revenues will go down. And Susan Davis, I'm wondering if you have heard in the debate in Congress, you know, any discussion of this issue in Greece, whether the package that is designed for Greece will actually hurt the economy there as opposed to bring it closer to a balanced budget.
I do think rhetorically you hear a lot of references to Greece, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle. I think Greg is right in saying that the policy parallels are not exactly the same, but it is politically a good rhetorical talking point that you hear a lot where they say, if we don't fix our debt situation, we're going to end up like Greece. And I think – not that I think most Americans have a very formal knowledge of the Greek economic system, but there is sort of this subtle or not so subtle political message that we would be becoming more like Europe or more un-American or we're losing our way. It's sort of a code word when we say we're becoming more like Greece. It's just a way of saying that that something dramatic needs to happen. I think it's very popular among Republican voters. I think it resonates with them when you talk in that way. But that, I will say on the other end, Democrats, when you're talking about your point of spending cuts, I mean, there's a lot of Democrats that aren't going to vote for whatever this debt ceiling deal is in the end, and I'm still confident that in the end something will happen, who say right now, I mean, we're still at 9% unemployment. We're still – the U.S. economic recovery isn't really where we need it to be. And there is a policy argument that says if all you do on one side of the ledger is cut hundreds of billions of dollars in annual spending over the next 10 years, it's not going to create jobs. It's not going to make – it's not going to get our employment levels where we need it to be. So it is sort of a Band-Aid for a larger problem in this country, which is stagnant job creation.
And meanwhile, a big player in Greece is the International Monetary Fund, and a pretty dramatic development this morning. Jack Beatty, we open up the New York Times and see above the fold the headline that prosecutors are no longer quite so sure about the case against Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the disgraced former IMF director who was charged, who was accused of raping a maid in his hotel room. Now it's not as clear, is it, Jack, what's going to happen in that case?
No, and as NPR pointed out, it's the prosecution that has surfaced this damaging background or evidence about this person. She apparently did not tell the truth on certain immigration forms about her background. She had some sort of unsavory link with an unsavory character who was sending money to her bank account. She had multiple phones going all the time. Who knows what she was doing? But all these things, of course, would be seized on by the defense to impeach her testimony, her credibility. And since it's a he said versus she said case,
careful there, Jack.
Yeah, that's what it all hangs on, her credibility. So it is an extraordinary turn of events.
Greg, your thoughts?
It's certainly a dramatic development here. I heard this morning that Strauss-Kahn even harbors hopes of returning to French politics, where up until this scandal had broken, he had been a leading contender to lead the Socialist Party into the next presidential election and might have knocked off Nicolas Sarkozy. It's also supremely ironic this comes just a few days after the IMF elected another French politician, Christine Lagarde, as the new managing director to replace Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who had stepped down from that position in the wake of those charges. But fundamentally, though, there's no question, either by the defense or the prosecution, that a sexual encounter did take place. The question is whether there was coercion involved. Mm-hmm. And I think it still leaves open the question of Strauss-Kahn's judgment and the fact that he had a pattern of problematic behavior with women. And so that part of the narrative hasn't changed yet.
Boy, it's hard to imagine that if he were a U.S. politician, he'd have any future, given what you just said, in American politics, but who knows. Beth is calling from Schenectady, New York. She's been following the Strauss-Kahn case. Hello, Beth. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. What about the other women that came forward and say this man went after them? I'm impressed that the NYPD did pursue the case, but sexual assault cases have something like a 10% success rate, and it's excruciatingly grueling for the victim. It's just the opposite of property crime cases. It's a woman. The fact that we're even discussing her background is a nightmare. So I'm impressed that the New York Police Department did bring the case. But what about all those other victims that came forward and said this man went after them? So this is just a complete nightmare that American women cannot bring a sexual assault case without being. Of course, she's probably going to end up recanting because she's being attacked.
Yeah,
and that's usually what happens. The woman doesn't say, "Oh, I wasn't raped." She says, "Fine, I cannot take it anymore. It's a 12-hour exam," and then they attack her personally, and the success rate is. Just like I said, it's about the opposite extreme of any other kind of case.
Well, we really just have to be careful because we don't know all the facts in this situation, do we, Susan Davis?
No, I think that's completely right. I mean, the thing that I would just note that, and I'm basing this on what I read in the paper along with everyone else, is that these revelations were brought forward by the prosecuting team. That it wasn't the defense.
Right.
It hasn't gone to trial yet. That the accuser has not been subjected to sort of the public. But that the prosecution has basically said they don't know if they have enough to make the case, which is sort of a stunning. That is what makes it so stunning, in that they were so rhetorically sure of the case in the beginning when they arrested him and the bail and the terms of his house arrest that it seemed like it was a shut and close kind of case. And now what we're seeing is the criminal past, the fact that she has lied repeatedly under oath, that her own story doesn't hold up, suggests that it doesn't seem in the end that he is probably going to face criminal charges of what we originally thought. I will say that the caller does make the point that beyond this case, he did have a reputation. He did have his relationships with women were well known. So it might be one of those things that in the end, the right thing is that maybe he's not running for office, but it's also the right thing that he's not legally charged.
Well, and we should point out one other thing. You know, some members of Dominique Strauss-Kahn's party in France were alleging or suggesting that perhaps he had been set up in order to take him out of the political competition. Investigators in this case say they have found no evidence of that whatsoever. Let's move now to the situation in Minnesota, another place where we're facing a dramatic standoff in the legislature. The government services in Minnesota, as of this morning, have been shut down, and that includes all the state parks on this 4th of July weekend. The gates are closed. People who want to go to state parks for a weekend celebration, a 4th of July weekend celebration, will not be able to get in because the legislature and the governor there as well have not been able to agree on a budget plan. The time came when agreement had to be made. A deadline was there, and it passed. The government is shut down. Republican State Senator Jeff Michael of Minnesota spoke today about his state's government shutdown.
Very disappointing. Very disheartening. This is going to, I think, be one of those moments in our state's history that we'll look back on and be very disappointed on.
Jack Beatty, did everyone see this coming, or is this sort of a surprise to those of us on the national scene?
It's certainly a surprise to me. I knew there was trouble there, and in fact, it was sort of the Minnesota's budget troubles were part of the sort of background of the Tim Pawlenty candidacy. People were saying he's left Minnesota in a terrible state. Well, he didn't leave it. Minnesota had a big budget deficit. But, you know, listen to the words here. Governor Dayton says that he was elected. He said he called for collecting more in income taxes, the Times write, from the very highest earners to spare cuts in services to the most vulnerable. That's exactly what President Obama is saying at the national level. And they quote further on in the story, a professor at the University of Minnesota saying, Minnesota is now on the cusp of ungovernability. Well, of course, in 30 days, the United States might be on that very cusp. It's this feeling. I mean, sure, Greece isn't exactly analogous, but this one is much closer, isn't it? I mean, it's right there, and we see it happening between a Republican Party elected to cut spending and to, you know, avoid any kind of tax increase, and a Democratic governor saying that would be too much to do it all to deal with the $5 billion deficit. Strictly with spending cuts, it would hurt too many people. We have to have taxes on the affluent, an impasse. That's the situation in Washington as well.
Well, meanwhile, Greg Gipp, some Republicans in Minnesota, while they say they are absolutely opposed to raising taxes, are willing to talk about what they call revenue raisers. Now, I'm not sure what the difference between a tax raise and a revenue raise is, but they're calling, they are apparently willing to talk about some health care surcharges, some state fees. Are these just taxes, tax increases by another name?
Oh, absolutely. There is an important difference. If you don't call it a tax increase, you can with a straight face claim you didn't break the pledge that you made to Grover Norquist and Americans for Tax Reform, which has managed to get most of the Republican caucus in Washington and many Republicans at state level to promise never to raise taxes. And this is a pretty crucial distinction, whether raising marginal tax rates is different from closing tax breaks, such as your ability to deduct a corporate jet if you're a company, or depreciation if you're an oil company, or mortgage interest and charitable deductions if you just happen to be a wealthy individual. And this is precisely the needle that the Obama administration is trying to thread. The negotiations that Joe Biden, the vice president, were leading broke down when the administration put forward roughly $400 billion in revenue raisers, none of which involved raising marginal tax rates. They were all about closing tax breaks, as we were just discussing. What's intriguing is that it's difficult to tell whether the Republicans are united in their view about whether that would be a tax increase. When I sort of parse what some of their leaders have been saying, you can almost take it both ways. Mitch McConnell repeatedly says no tax increases, no tax increases. When you try and get him to say, does that mean that you would never consider closing some of these tax breaks? No tax increases. And John Kyle, who was leading the negotiations for the Republicans on the Senate side, explicitly said that they never took revenue off the table. So if this impasse is to be broken, almost certainly that will be one of the ways it's done.
Well, taxes are certainly on the top of the mind of our listeners. William is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. William, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Yeah, I read recently that if Congress actually did nothing, that they would solve the short-term budgetary issues and the tax, the Bush tax cuts would expire at the end of this year. It wouldn't get us to from August to January, but if in effect they did that, that would actually produce enough revenue to take care of the entire short-term problem. I was interested in your panelists commenting on that.
Susan Davis, you have a thought on that?
I do. It's actually, I can't remember the exact source of where that came from, but I know exactly what the caller is talking about. It was this idea when we talk about the deficit situation right now, and everyone agrees that it's in grave terms. And someone did a sort of an academic exercise that said, if Congress did absolutely nothing, it would work out eventually. And where you get that from is that he's correct. If you let the Bush tax cuts expire, which I actually think go through 2013, not through the end of this year, and if you presume that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are scaled back on the schedule that they've outlined, I think it's also the AMT patch, the alternative minimum tax patch, if that is allowed to expire, that all of that would be enough to generate revenues to balance the budget over an X amount of years. I mean, again, I think – and one of the things we've repeatedly touched on and to the caller – these are not necessarily the most complicated policy issues. We know what the answers are to balance budgets. Mm-hmm. I think the difficulty in this is almost always the politics.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was found guilty of a wide range of corruption charges. Here he is moments after the verdict.
Among the many lessons that I've learned from this whole experience is to try to speak a little bit less, so I'm going to keep my remarks kind of short. Patty and I obviously are very disappointed in the outcome. I, frankly, am stunned.
At New York's Pride Parade, joy over the gay marriage law.
I'm thrilled. I think it's about time we had justice, especially New York State. Justice and equality, it's a great day for gays and New York.
And a tense situation in New Mexico all week as wildfires got too close for comfort to the Los Alamos nuclear lab. Here's Fire Chief Doug Tucker.
We have seen fire behavior we have never seen down here, and it's really aggressive. We talked about repopulating the community, looking for Friday, Saturday. That's not going to happen. This fire is too active.
The fire chief says that the fire is under control and is unlikely to reach the nuclear laboratory. We've got a great panel with us today, as usual. We're joined by Susan Davis from the National Journal, Greg Ipp from The Economist, and On Point's Jack Beatty. And meanwhile, with the partisan rhetoric about the debt ceiling in the background, Michelle Bachmann, the Republican from Minnesota, this week declared her intention to run for president at a South Carolina town hall meeting on Wednesday. She talked about a miscarriage she had two decades ago, which cemented her stance against abortion.
We ended up losing that child. And it was devastating for both of us, as you can imagine, if any of you have lost a child. And at that moment, we didn't think of ourselves as overly career-minded or overly materialistic, but when we lost that child, it changed us, and it changed us forever. And so we made a commitment that no matter how many children were brought into our life, we would receive them, because we're committed to life.
And Jack Beatty, Michelle Bachmann, for Michelle Bachmann, these social issues like abortion, like her opposition to gay marriage, have always been at the forefront. And yet we've seen from some a new CBS poll that just came out yesterday that jobs in the economy are at the very forefront. How do you assess the prospects for Michelle Bachmann's nomination for the Republican to be the Republican nominee?
Well, those are probably remote. But, you know, a month ago, David Axelrod, President Obama's political strategist, wrote the names of the two Republican challenges he most feared on a whiteboard in his Chicago office. Michelle Bachmann was not one of them, but she appears to have derailed Tim Pawlenty, who was. Mitt Romney is the other. I think that's the early significance of Ms. Bachmann, now tied in the Iowa polls with Romney while Pawlenty languishes. She broke through in the same CNN debate in which Pawlenty failed to deliver on his billing as the anti-Romney. Bachmann is prone to hollers, vulnerable to the criticism that she's benefited from the kind of government program she denounces. Nevertheless, she may have a gaffe-proof grip on Iowa evangelicals for precisely the kind of rhetoric we just heard. They made Mike Huckabee the winner of the caucus in 2008. They could do it for her next year. But, you know, that race in Iowa is still in co-ed, and so is the national race. And Pawlenty's eclipse by Bachmann opens the door to another potential anti-Romney, Texas Governor Rick Perry, who's second to Romney in a new Fox poll. He competes with Bachmann for the religious right and with Romney for the big business wing of the GOP. Born in a Texas town so small it only made the map when he became governor, and into a family so poor they used an outhouse, Perry has a story Romney can't match and a record as a job creator to offset Romney's business expertise.
And Greg Ipp, how do you assess Governor Perry's record for job creation in Texas? This is clearly the issue that he would run on if he does announce. And as I said, we've seen poll results that show that this is an issue that would resound with American voters. What is his job creation record in Texas, Greg?
Well, Texas actually had one of the best job records in terms of a smaller increase in unemployment and much higher rates of employment growth than almost any other major state during the recession and in the subsequent recovery. Now, one shouldn't go too far with that. A lot of that was thanks to basically in-migration. Texas never had a housing bubble, partly because it's so cheap and easy to build houses in Texas that it's hard to get their prices up to bubble-like levels. Certainly not the case in the, on the coast or up here in the northeast of the United States. So, however, that said, Perry is definitely, even if some of the prosperity that Texas carried through this period wasn't Perry's doing, he'll definitely benefit from that. Now, however, I would say, though, that some of the momentum seems to have been lost recently, and Texas is grappling some of those same difficult budgetary issues that, for example, Minnesota is. All that said, I think that the thing that might hold Michelle Bachmann back is whether, in fact, as you're saying, economic issues trump social issues in the coming election. And given that the economy does seem to be struggling to develop any momentum, I think it will be hard for that social, those social issue candidates to really prevail. I mean, we have seen, in some sense, a shaking out of the ranks of the presidential contenders in the last month or two with people. And I think the fact that Romney is now the clear front runner speaks a lot to the fact that even though he doesn't press all the right buttons, he may not press any of the right buttons, frankly, on the social issues agenda, is that his strength on business and management and economics trumps all those things.
Let's go now to Valerie. She's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hello, Valerie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. I live in the Heartlands where we're having an ongoing disaster of the floods, and we're having lots of federal money, I believe, helping to fund the fight against that flood, building levees, the Corps of Engineers, people working, doing extra work at the nuclear plants. What happens if the budget doesn't get passed to the funding for that disaster relief?
Well, thank you, Valerie. Susan Davis, usually in these situations, there are certain categories of spending that are considered emergency or priority, correct?
Correct. I mean, there's no easy answer to the caller because we just – it's a question based on a hypothetical. We don't know how it's – if it's going to happen yet. I would say that I find it hard to believe, as deadlocked as things are and as bad as the politics are on this, that if something like fires were threatening a nuclear facility, I don't think there's any member of Congress or the president that would allow funds not to go to prevent that. So I do think the worst case scenario type of situations are likely to be headed off. The kinds of things that I do think are more practical and more likely to be concerned about is things like beneficiary payments for Social Security and Medicare, certain more in terms of payments, not in terms of the safety and security of the United States, either domestic or abroad.
Tom, I'd like to just jump in for a second.
Yes,
there,
please, Greg.
Which is that Susan's absolutely right. Normally in these situations, Congress carves out an exception for emergency spending. The point I would add, though, is that we're somewhat in uncharted territory here. That is, in fact, the usual MO that we pursue when there's a typical government shutdown situation, when Congress simply won't appropriate the money need to pay for these things. What we're dealing with now is a possibility that the money simply won't be there. We've already appropriated it, but the government doesn't have the authority to go out and borrow it. And it's not clear how you deal with these competing needs, whether it's emergency, whether it's defense, whether it's Social Security.
Well, let's turn our attention overseas now. We've been really pretty focused on economic issues here at home. But in Afghanistan this week, a deadly attack on the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul. 21 people were killed there, including the 9 suicide bombers. The nine people who attacked, the last 3 of whom were killed only when NATO helicopters came in and shot them on the roof. So U.S. troops had to intervene there. There were some reports that the Afghan police, who were responsible for protecting the hotel, actually ran away when it was attacked. Jack Beatty, what do you think is the significance of that event?
Well, you know, ponder the motivation of these Taliban attackers. Leave out value judgments about their cause. They stormed the hotel knowing it was their grave, while, as you say, there are reports that the Afghan police, or some of them, who were supposed to guard the hotel, ran. You know, no amount of training can make people fight for a corrupt government so feckless that it can't protect one of the most politically sensitive buildings in its capital, much less the families of its police and soldiers vulnerable to Taliban terror in the night. The Taliban fighters who stormed the hotel knew that behind their cause was a powerful state, Pakistan. It will be there long after 2014. The Afghan police, they knew that the Americans and their allies will quit the fight in 2014. Which brings us back to the, you know, that signature quotation of the war, the Taliban leader's lapidary remarks, "The Americans may have the watches, but we have the time." And in setting his 2014 deadline for the transition to what would be a miracle in all Afghan defense, President Obama ceded the time to the Taliban. He offered them no incentive to negotiate a peace deal before the American watches say time's up. Henry Kissinger has complained that Obama has no long-term strategy in Afghanistan, training soldiers in the bootless hope that they'll fight for the more corrupt side in a civil war. That's not a strategy. It's a fig leaf to delay and disguise defeat.
And that's, of course, what's awkward about this for the Obama administration, coming just as it did days after President Obama announced the drawdown of U.S. troops there. Of course, the premise of that drawdown is that the Afghans themselves would be capable of taking over the security of their country. Susan Davis, what's your sense of the politics in Congress over the Afghanistan issue? We've seen divisions within the Republican Party over whether the United States should deepen or reduce its involvement in Afghanistan as well as in other places. Where do you see this debate standing right now on Capitol Hill?
It is interesting because it's such an important debate, but it is one that has certainly taken a back seat, in particularly in light of these economic issues. I will say that John Boehner, who's the Speaker of the House, has been somewhat candid in recent weeks and months in acknowledging that there's a lot of war weariness on Capitol Hill, that especially not only from the fiscal policy of what the wars have cost, but from the question of the mission in Afghanistan. I do think there is a commitment, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, to see it through or to be able to, say, declare some sort of victory in the end. But I do think that the support, I don't want to say it's softened, but I do think that the amount of skepticism, the amount of oversight over the war, it is changing. And I think there is a willingness, there's a large willingness that members would like to see the war draw down and come to a close, but they also would like to be able to say that it was a victory of some kind. And I think that in one way, this is an area where the president has a lot of allies on Capitol Hill in the Republican Party, and this is one area in which he can rely on them, because on the opposite end, among the Democratic ranks, particularly in the House, I think weariness would almost be a kind word. I think they're tired of it. I think they want the troops to come home. And I think the support on the left that was patient of the president's war policy in his first years in office has really grown thin.
And of course, that attack in Kabul came just as Defense Secretary Robert Gates was stepping down from his position. That's a position he's held for the past 4.5 years. He received a Presidential Medal of Freedom for his service, and he spoke at his farewell ceremony at the Pentagon yesterday about America's place in the world.
A sense of America's exceptional global responsibilities and the importance of what we do or do not do remain the great musts of this dangerous new century. It is the sacred duty entrusted to all of us privileged to serve in positions of leadership and responsibility, a duty we should never forget or take lightly, a duty I have every confidence you will all continue to fulfill.
And Greg Gipp, Robert Gates, who was himself a former CIA director, will be replaced by the outgoing CIA director, Leon Panetta. I would think this must be the first time in American history where you've had two defense secretaries serving back to back after previously serving in the CIA. How do you sense that Leon Panetta going to the Pentagon is going to be a new factor in the wars in which the United States is engaged in right now?
Well, I guess what I see as significant is that between Gates' retirement and Panetta taking over, and the other thing that's interesting is that David Petraeus, who we didn't mention,
right,
is leaving the Pentagon to become the new CIA director. And both Panetta and Petraeus were basically confirmed in those positions in the Senate by overwhelming bipartisan majorities. So it's, you know, amidst all this partisan sort of rhetoric that divides us on economic questions, you know, going back to some of the points Susan was making, it's interesting that the, at least on the national security side, that there's less of that sort of partisan divide obvious. I would defer to the others more on exactly how this is going to affect our execution of the wars.
Well, Jack Beatty, just as Robert Gates was retiring and Leon Panetta was going over to the Pentagon, the White House counterterrorism advisor John Brennan announced that there would be a new strategy. And this seems to be a new strategy for fighting terrorism, for fighting al-Qaeda. And it seems to be very heavily dependent on CIA-type approaches. He said that there would be targeted surgical pressure, more special operations, more drone attacks, and less land warfare. This would seem to be the theme of the day as far as how we're going to be, how the United States is going to be attacking radicalism here in the coming months.
Yes, and it's the opposite strategy from the one with which Gates has been identified. You know, his resignation may remind some listeners of Robert McNamara's in 1967. President Johnson charged McNamara's replacement, Clark Clifford, with de-escalating the Vietnam War, which is the charge President Obama has given to Leon Panetta. Gates came reluctantly, apparently, to support the Afghanistan escalation, the surge, but he believes in it now more than the president, who's withdrawing more troops faster than Gates or the Pentagon want, and who wants to adopt a counterterrorism strategy. Obama also charged Panetta, incidentally, with cutting the defense budget below anything acceptable to Gates. So in Afghanistan, as on the budget, Gates was really in the way. It was time for him to go.
And there is one other story that we really didn't get to this week, but lest we leave the impression that it's only partisan politics that govern in Washington, Republicans and Democrats do seem to be making some progress on trade deals for Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. Those are agreements that were first negotiated by the Bush administration, but progress on getting them approved has been stalled. There does seem to be some movement toward getting those deals now approved. So we're going to leave on that semi-positive outlook. Greg Ipp is the U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Susan Davis, she's the congressional correspondent for National Journal. Susan, it's been great to have you.
Happy 4th of July, Tom.
Same to you, Susan. And Jack Beatty, thanks. And you have a great 4th of July weekend, Jack.
Thank you very much. And it's been great to have you on the show this week.
Well, thank you very much, Jack. It's been really fun. And you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.